Welcome to the Uncharted Podcast. Uncharted is a community of some of the world's best entrepreneurs, founders, investors, creatives, and beyond. At our dinners and at our annual summit in New York, we have dialogues with people who are truly at the top of their game across every industry. This podcast is designed really to offer the world and the audience a peek into the magical conversations that happen behind closed doors at our events, and more importantly, a peek into the brains of people who are truly at the top of their game. My goal with every guest is that if you know them well, you'll hear them talk about something or say something they've really never said before, and if you've never heard of them, you'll know exactly what makes them such a badass by the time the episode is over. Welcome to Uncharted. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for doing this. I want to pick up the conversation we were just having, but now that the audience is tuned in officially, I want to make sure I set some context for who you are and your story. You are a founder, you're a marketer, you're a VC, you're your own fund manager now. You've raised a fund, you're crushing it. Let's fill in some blanks for the Uncharted community. I want to get into your background. I want to get into running a fund. I want to get into fund economics. Give us 30 seconds about the origin of you starting a company in your dorm room from Goldman, how that led you to become a marketer, and of course, now how you're running your own fund with Divergent.
Okay. Small business parents, grew up like Queens, Long Island border. Everyone I respected and loved and admired ran a business. So just in the blood pretty early. Went to NYU Stern, studied finance and marketing, got very involved in creating the startup community there. Finance school, ran the entrepreneurship club, launched a cafe for students, run by students. Intern at Goldman, I'm 5'1", so is my best friend at the time, Susie Levitt. We're in heels all day on trading floors, our feet were on fire, and we invented these patented ballet flats that you could fold up, came in a little pouch. When your heels like hurt, you could put the flats on, and then the pouch opened up to a tote bag and you put your heels in it. That was really the start of my entrepreneurship journey. We bootstrapped that business, got it to millions of dollars in revenue, profitability, bootstrapped it, sold it in 2013, started angel investing after that, as you know, the day job was running sales and marketing teams at venture-backed startups.
Did you have a good exit? Was it like a good outcome?
Yeah. I mean, it was like very good at 25, going from being a broke college student to a broke startup founder and not consistently paying yourselves over a four-year journey. Like, it was awesome.
Yeah. So you sold the company at 25 and made some money.
Yes. And my partner actually ended up staying at that company for 10 years.
Wow.
I realized very quickly, like, I just wanted to build. Like, I loved the 0 to 10 million revenue stage. I wasn't as hopelessly addicted to, like, fashion as, like, my core driver. And started angel investing after that liquidity event. Made about 20 angel investments, kind of the nights and weekends while I was, you know, running sales and marketing teams, venture-backed startups in New York. Really, that 0 to 30 million revenue stage has been my sweet spot.
And that was your business, consulting, running market.
Yeah. So went to a retail tech company called Order Groove. You could think of them as Amazon Subscribe and Save for everybody else.
Yeah.
So white label subscription platform. We sold to Walmart, CVS, L'Oreal. There was a mid-market business there and an enterprise business. I then left to join HomeJoy as the GM of New York.
Sure.
We can talk about that over tequila. Like, imploded fabulously after I, about like 6 to 8 months after I joined. So that was a good lesson.
That's fun. Yeah.
Like, the things to look for,
yeah,
you know, what big fundraisers don't guarantee big outcomes. Lots of learnings on kind of what happens when you try to scale too quickly. And then I ran a fractional, like, growth consultancy for a few years before making the jump officially to the dark side of venture in 2017. So joined a group called Kairos, which I think you guys know too. Partnered up with Ankur Jain, Ryan Bloomer, Alex Vyas, and then became hopelessly addicted to the industry, the asset class, pre-seed in particular. Like, I feel like I'm a bit more of a talent scout than a financial investor in most ways. Yeah, love trying to bet on talent before it's obvious to everyone else that talent should be bet on.
So now you're running your own fund. 30 million is the size of the
30
fund.
30 million fund one.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience and jump from being a founder or founder adjacent as a CMO, but also founding your own consulting company to what explicitly made you fall in love with investing. And I'm going to do a follow-up question to try to probe a little bit deeper into this. I think the easy answer that a lot of VCs gives, as someone who also runs a fund, right? Like, I think it's very easy to say, oh, I love working with founders. But I think there's realities to both the business model, the economics, and I would say just like the time and quality of life that I think is often what's not spoken about under the surface about what it's like to be a founder versus what it's like to be a VC. I also think there's a big distinction that I want to hear you talk about between joining a fund and starting a fund.
Totally.
Very, very different worlds.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about what brought you into VC to start, and I guess the observations that you had that made you say, this is actually what I want to do.
Yeah. What brought me into VC to start was we actually started Kairos as a nonprofit in college.
That's right.
This was 2008, 2009. Startups were not cool. It was insane that I didn't take an offer from Goldman Sachs. Like, it was Rent the Runway was just starting. Like, there really wasn't much happening.
Sure.
When you were on the tech ecosystem side. So really, it was, I mean, quite serendipitous. But we started Kairos as a nonprofit. It was a fellowship program for college entrepreneurs. I was in their first batch. You know, there was like an annual media recognition, like an annual summit. I was in their first batch of K50 companies with CitySlips. And, you know, 7 years of like running this nonprofit, a student-run organization, we had 7 years of K50 lists where we had gotten thousands of applications and we had chosen 50 every year. And we looked back at the companies and the founders that were on those lists and we were like, wow, we would have like 17x the non-existent fund.
Right.
So that was kind of like the aha moment of, okay, yeah, yes, we're young and we weren't trained institutionally to be venture investors, but you know, maybe this group actually has a good knack at like picking talent early. So I had made probably about 15 or so angel investments at that time.
Yep.
Had gotten lucky on, you know, some of my earlier investments, like Bombas Socks.
Shout out David Heath, also Uncharted member.
He's the best.
Total killer.
And when Kairos had raised the fund, basically the guys reached back out and were like, hey, your name keeps coming up.
Yeah.
You must come and join as a partner. And so I think for me, I do like working with founders like everybody else. It's just, this is the side of the table that, like, I actually didn't really enjoy being the front-facing founder of everything.
Yep.
Like, sales were so attached to our face and our name and the lists and the, we did home shopping channels. And I was doing it. And I was like, I just want to be behind the scenes, like, coaching and connecting. And so I think once I realized, like, venture was an asset class, I was like, wait, I don't have to just keep angel investing and, like, draining my bank account. Like, you can actually get paid to do this job. Like, once I got to Kairos and the four of us worked so well together, I was hooked. I was like, you can help founders. Like, I'd made so many mistakes as a founder and operator. And I was like, I can save people like all of that stress and those tears and like those learnings.
Yeah.
And I could participate in the upside of their businesses. I was like, there's literally no better job than this. And I loved Kairos. I still talk to the guys all the time. After probably 3-4 years there, they were moving a bit more in an incubation direction. And I loved like the early stage pre-seed, like check writing. I felt like I had gotten some of my operating kicks already, having run and sold a company, having kind of been involved with early teams as kind of this fractional CMO. And alongside that, I had met my now partner, Lucy. I spent my whole career on the growth and revenue side. Lucy spent her whole career on the tech and science side. And I just became more and more convinced
that you're a good partner.
Like, we covered each other's blind spots in a way that I had not experienced before professionally. We did a founder survey recently, just like, how are we doing? What did we do good? What did we do bad? I think one of my favorite takeaways from the survey was one of our founders said, you know, I think because we've been operators and because we were in startups before it was cool and sexy to be in startups, it was actually like uncool.
Yep.
We're like supposed to be here. This is the thing we love.
Yeah.
Nothing really scares us. Mm. Like, he was like, you know, you guys just are not afraid to look at the ugly stuff with us and just like problem solve. And I think because we've been operators and there's some brilliant career investors out there, don't get me wrong, but where we need to win, which is kind of like this first fundraise.
Yeah.
I think the operating chops and the fact that we know that no matter what the graphs look like, something is imploding inside. And like, that doesn't scare us. And we know that. I think founders really appreciate that. I love that. It's a 10 to 15 year journey that we're signing up on. Like, it's not going to be all up and to the right, even for like the deck of corns at the end. It seems like that in hindsight, but it's never. It never is.
I had a conversation with a buddy of mine this weekend. We were just catching up and working out, and he said something that stuck with me. He was like, I'm so tired of entrepreneurs when I go to these events, when they're asked how it's going, saying like, oh man, everything's awesome. Like, it's all so good. And he was like, if I've learned anything, it's that if it's actually awesome, you should feel like it's freaking terrible and everything's on fire. He's like, having been a part of businesses where it ain't working and having been a part of businesses where it's really working, when it's really working, everything's on fire. And he was like, there's this lack of willingness to be honest and open. We were just talking about this offline.
A lot of posturing. So many
so much posturing
in this industry. That's my least favorite part of the industry. It's like, diversion is like a very, I think it just follows the ethos of Lucy and I. Like, Lucy doesn't have a Twitter account. Like, we barely have a website. We have a landing page. We are not writing or posting. I think anyone who knows us and the LPs that believe in us and get excited about us, we tell them, we're like, if you just call 10 of our founders, you're going to write the check. Like, the digital presence is terrible, but like, we hope that we're taking the longer way to build brand, which is just like performance and reputation. And I think that resonates with the right type of cohort. And honestly, when I think about some of my most successful investments historically, the founders tend to be a little bit more like that too.
Hmm.
Like, they're more heads down.
Less public.
They're obsessed with their customers. They're obsessed with their employees. And they kind of like don't care about the TechCrunch articles.
I want to nerd out on venture stuff, having just raised a fund, but I want to double click on that quickly.
Sure.
There is so much attention right now, myself included, around the importance and value of how, for lack of a better word, active you are on Twitter, LinkedIn. I think there's a very good argument to be made for it. And, you know, we could list a million reasons why there's benefits to having a good public personality and
100%.
The funnel and all that.
Totally.
Give me a more substantiated POV on why you think or how explicitly it's benefited you to not have that public persona.
I think the most important part of this debate or conversation is, what is your personality actually like?
Mm.
Like, if you are a great writer and you like naturally are always thinking of interesting facts and you want to share them, and I think then it's like incredibly conducive. There's no downside to building a brand, especially if it comes naturally to you. I think the question is like, why are people doing it? Is it, it feels good and they like it and they get likes and they get feedback and they get retweets and it feels good, which is a perfectly valid reason. In an industry, it's very hard. Like, anything that makes you feel good, like, you should probably invest time in it. I think where sometimes it can go a little wrong is if you don't like it, it feels unnatural. You're doing it for like transactional reasons and it just doesn't feel as right.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not convinced a ton of VCs are getting their best deals from their tweets. I could be wrong, but I think it's more of just like, you're just top of mind more. And there's a ton of recency bias in this industry. So like, I think that's a huge place where it could work for people that are like more vocal publicly. For me and Lucy, like, I cringe at the idea of like writing a blog post and tweeting. And so I've been doing this for a long time. Like, I'm just best in small rooms of people.
Yeah.
Like even podcasts, like, this is just so much, it's so much easier for me to kind of just talk to somebody than proactively think about what I want to write and then publish it. We do get some pushback on this from LPs, so we can talk about that too. People are like, you have such interesting networks and such interesting opinions. Like, why are you guys not sharing them? It just doesn't
feel
like
this. Do you hold the
line
or are you just kind of like gently ignoring them? Like, are you pushing back on like, it's not worth our time?
We push back, yeah. And I think like, we always say, hey, maybe Fund 3-4 is different, but it does not feel like the best use of our time as we're like building this franchise. Like, performance is ultimately what's going to win in venture.
Of course.
So it's all kind of just feel good stuff in the short term. The way Lucy and I kind of say it is like, look, you know, if we have 30 minutes, we're going to call like a stressed out founder. We're not going to write a blog post about like why we chose this company. And, you know, I think you see on the flip side too, it's like when you have big exits, you get all these like blog posts about, I knew it from day zero that like this was going to be a $20 billion company. And it's like, well, what about like the 80% that you thought were going to return your fund that didn't? So there's just something about it that there's some people that are so amazing at it. And I respect them profoundly for it. But like, one, I wouldn't be good at it. And two, it doesn't feel good.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about what it's like to raise a fund. Many people who are listening right now will understand exactly what goes into that. But for those who don't, right, the Uncharted audience, there's a lot of advertising executives. There's a lot of marketers. There's a lot of founders. We have a lot of VCs, but I want to unpack this in layman's terms for people who are less familiar with what actually goes into raising your own fund. Tell us in the simplest words possible what that means, what you're actually doing, who you're going to raise money from, and what that conversation looks like with your first fund.
So my LPs are investing in a blind pool of approximately 30 future investments. It's a portfolio industry. The actual legal vehicle is a 10-year vehicle. People tend to extend it, but like, you're trying to basically find companies at year 1, 2, and 3 that will IPO or have large M&A transactions at year 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You're typically really good at the job if your fund can 3x net over that like 10 to 12 year period.
And that meaning after you get paid.
Yes. So it's also a power law like industry. So of those 30 companies, everyone's a little bit different, but like you could make a solid argument that probably five are like going to be the most impactful from a returns perspective.
Out of how many?
30 right. in this like example, and that's probably that will be
80-20.
I think the other layer to think about it for folks less familiar is, especially for somebody like me, you know, basically, let's just say we're doing an investment. We're putting $1 million into a company on a $10 million valuation. So we're owning 10% of that company up front. For a really long time, this is an industry that just a bigger later stage fund says the company is worth more on paper. And then another fund says the company is worth more on paper.
Yeah.
So for many, many years of running a fund, which I think is probably one of the biggest transitions from being a founder operator, it's like the length of the feedback loop. That's not just vanity metric.
Yeah.
Is very long. Somebody like me, it's not crazy that I'll get diluted 70% alongside a founder from kind of raising their first few $1 million to an exit.
Yeah.
And I'm biased here, but like I will preach small funds forever because of that, right? So even with that dilution, you know, if I have 3% of a $1 billion outcome, the back of the math, like that would make me $30 million. And then I'm on my way to like returning my fund and, you know, a couple more transactions hopefully gets you to like 3, 4, 5, 10x your fund. Was that simple?
Yeah, 100%. Okay. One of the things about venture and fund managers, specifically emerging ones, that I find fascinating, having just gone through raising my first fund, is that in your early conversations, before there is a institutional track record, i.e. you can point to the fund one returns and say, here's my strategy, here's why it works. You're going in front of rich people or institutions and saying, it's a pretty crazy concept, right? I would like you to commit as little as $500,000 and as much as $10 million into a pool of capital that I can't tell you exactly what I'm going to do with yet.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get paid on it every single year, but I'm going to make it 3x at least if my job goes well.
Right.
Trust me,
yeah.
basically, which is a big ask.
So you have
right?
to figure out how to create that trust.
Correct.
For us, we had a 50 company track record between personal investments and investments we made as partners of venture funds. Like I was coming out of Kairos, Lucy was at Greycroft and 112 Capital. So that definitely helped.
Yep.
Frankly, I think we got a little less credit for that than I thought we would. Mm. We were also raising during COVID over Zoom. So like there's a lot of variables happening. A lot of people would take calls, but it was very hard to get someone to write you a $5 million check.
Tell the audience about those calls. What happened when, I don't know who your LPs are, but I'm assuming family office, multifamily office, pension funds, things like that.
So $30 million fund is about 1/3 high net worth. That mostly looks like GPs of tier one funds that had co-invested in our companies that we'd raised in the past. So founders of Thrive, Union Square Ventures, First Round, Greycroft, and our founders that had exited and like had been with us on that journey. That's kind of the first cohort of LPs. That got us to family offices, 1/3 of our LP base, and then institutions at the end. So foundations, fund of funds, corporate.
And they came in last.
Yeah, and literally exactly in that order.
In that order.
So like if, you know, from an advice perspective, whenever folks reach out to me about raising a fund, it's like, who are the people that are obsessed with you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is where you start. Whether or not they have a ton of money, like, you must start there. That's a de-risker, same for a founder, right? It's like, does anyone who knows you a lot better than my three-week diligence process, like, are they at the table, right? It's very similar for managers.
Trust.
Totally.
Trust.
So I think track record helped. And then getting these more established GPs and our founders around help, that got us the next cohort, and that kind of got us to the next cohort.
Yeah. How long did it take to raise first fund, ballpark?
1 year between the first close and the final close, and some pre-selling before that, and five closes.
Wow.
So like we
almost
did not
nickel to me,
we did not play the fake deadline game. Like some people are so good at
try?
It. No.
Really?
And I just like it didn't feel right to us, and we probably could have done it faster. I think we just. We had an LLC that Lucy and I had invested out of for a couple years that we were warehousing. The cost basis was small, but I think, like, to your point, it made the blind pool a little bit less blind.
Yeah.
We're like, the check size is smaller than, you know, us leading a deal at Divergent, but these are the types of companies that Lucy and I are attracted to.
Yeah.
I think that was very helpful. So I guide folks on that a lot, too. It's like, even if you could just put, like, 5, 10K into something with some friends, 25K, 50K, just being able to talk about companies instead of just a totally blind pool, I think was very helpful for us.
You have told me, and I've seen this just based on the deals that you've done, that you are somewhat ruthless on valuation.
Yeah.
I think that's critical. I think that in, and I want to hear your commentary on this, in the game of VC and founders, we can and we need to be highly collaborative and talk about partnerships and all that. But at the end of the day, for the fund economics to work, especially at the size that you and I are playing at,
Totally.
entry price really matters
Yeah.
and ownership really matters. And I'm sure you've seen, as I have, a lot of fund managers make the mistake, at least in theory and certainly in practice, it plays out, of just saying a 10K check, for lack of a better word, 100K check, a million check into a bunch of different companies. Something's going to hit, roll the
Yeah.
dice and see what
Right.
happens. Talk about your approach to both holding the line on those valuations and how you get there.
Totally. I think the cool thing about venture is there are a lot of ways to do it, right? Like, there's no like right way to do it. So I think largely like fund size is your strategy in a big way. I think if you're a large multi-stage fund, you can play a really different game. Like, you can put in the $500K million check as the optionality to like lead a massive Series A if the thing starts to pop. We're a $30 million fund. It's like we can't play that game. It doesn't make sense for us to play that game. We're going to miss some things because of that. And I think, but we have this historical track record when we think about our best investments, our like pre-seeds to unicorn investments, all of them we were entering at single digit valuation. So all sub 10, most of them sub 8, even more
And
sub
these are
7.
unicorn companies.
Yeah.
And let's just unpack that for the audience. That means that Katie with Divergent, there are companies today that are worth over $1 billion on the private markets or have IPO'd that she invested in when they were worth less than $10 million.
Pre-divergent, correct. Yes.
Pre-divergent,
I did
sorry,
my
yes.
first angel investment in 2014.
But the point is, you were entering into these companies where you could buy double-digit percentages
Right.
for what you would call a reasonable check size in term VC terms
Yeah.
that are now worth $1 billion.
Yeah, but I mean, yes, and of the 50, there's like 10 to 15. You know, there's a lot of things that are like the return drivers of our historical track
It's
record.
venture. It's power law.
And so I think the zeros happen. And, you know, I think some other incredible like founder feedback I've gotten over the years is the emails I write when zeros happen of like, I know you feel like your world is ending, but like, it's going to be fine. You're going to go get a big corporate job. You're going to like make a lot of money for a couple years. You're going to lick your wounds. And then you're going to realize how much you learned here. And you're like going to come back and do it again. And I'll probably write you a check again. So in those situations, it's reputation management. It's not returns management, like for the zeros, right? For the things that don't work out. You do have to put most of your time and attention into the winner.
The winners.
Yeah. For me, it always goes back to the math of it, of like, I know from investing since 2014 in this space, the argument that I've invested in the best of times, like zero interest environments, tons of bull runs, lots of paper markups, you're at least going to get diluted 50%. So I think that's the math of the portfolio construction for us.
What about someone who would say, Katie,
Pay
you're
up.
crushing it? Well, sure, pay up, but I'm talking about on the LP and fund sides, and then we'll get to the pay up in a second.
Right.
You're crushing it. I believe in your model. We want you to go 250 million for the next fund or 500 million for the next fund. You'll get rich on the fees alone,
Yeah.
right? But it
No,
sounds like you don't want to do
no
that.
interest.
Tell me why.
I hate managing people. And Lucy and I are 50-50 partnership. I think we're going to stay like that for a long time. Like, we want to have an equal partnership firm.
You have a team or it's just you two?
We have a lot of fractional help. So it's just us that make the investment decisions. We have a fractional CFO, a fractional EA. Amazing, like interns and fellows. Fund two, which we'll launch next year, will bring some of that in-house, like some of our fractional help to be full-time.
How big will fund two be?
50. I think
Not a
that
huge jump. 30 to 50 is very reasonable.
we still want to do pre-seed. I think
Yeah.
where a lot of the mispricing of the past couple years happened is because it was really easy to raise funds. And of course, you want to hire the best talent, so you should raise a little bit more so you have more fees. We're just trying to find six to eight pre-seed investments per year that we think have a chance of like changing the world for the better and making us and our LPs a ton of money. We don't want to become an SPV shop. We don't want to go later stage. We don't want to do an opportunity fund. And again, other people are doing it differently, but like, you don't need a big fund if you know that you want to have a small partnership and a fairly concentrated
Do you
strategy.
not do a ton of SPVs into the winners?
No.
You just let other funds take it? Why not do more?
Where am I going to find the time to do that? And I think like, there's something about the focus of just doing what you think you're the best at. Like, I'm not convinced I'm the best Series A, B, C picker. And I think a lot of folks that were cranking out SPVs in 20 to 2022 have a lot of explaining to do now. And I'd just rather not have to deal with the murkiness of that. I mean, even like taking it one step closer, we don't have a big follow-on strategy as a
At
pre-seed
all.
investor. 20%. But
That's
if you
pretty
think
low.
about where we enter, I think there's a solid argument that you know, pre-seed to seed, you still probably have found product market fit. The team's just like hitting milestones, cranking, even sometimes two rounds out from ours, like you're at Series A, you know? And so where we would even follow on feels like you're just paying more for something that's not truly de-risked. Like I could tell you of our 20 investments so far, you know, 15 have raised follow-on capital. We don't have any zeros yet. We've been deploying for 2 years. I could tell you the five or six that, you know, I'm the most excited about, but I've been doing this long enough to know that like it's very, you'd have to get so lucky to be right on the visibility of what your fund returners are going to be this early in the company life cycle. So if I was a multi-stage fund, if I was a bigger fund, I'd have a very different opinion on that. But that's what I think makes the most sense for returns for a small fund.
Do you think some of that, though, comes down to you invest across a bunch of different industries, yep, right? So you have outstanding pattern recognition to understand the commonalities between startups that can be successful. But yeah, right, if you have one in defense tech, one in AI, one in fintech, and there's going to be nuances to each of those that are really at the core of it, where the risk center is for, yeah, for how it's going to go from zero to one. Do you think that a lot of your unwillingness to follow on comes from how nuanced the growth trajectory is based on the industry?
It's an interesting question. I don't know. It almost feels closer to home. Like it feels more micro than macro to us. I think there's something also beautifully simplistic about being alongside a founder journey where you don't have to like ever posture. Like we're not leading your next round. We are a $30 million fund. We can't save you. I feel like it's very difficult when you're like, oh, you might have a large follow-on strategy. You're like, okay, how do you pick? When do you pick? In a situation where, you know, a founder is having, you know, they've missed milestones or they're having a hard time raising, it just makes it a simpler relationship. I'm with you, but I can't save you.
Simply, sure.
I bought the product already. Like now I'm on this boat with you and like we're in it together. And so I think we actually think about it more from like a just running
simplicity
the business perspective.
Understood.
Like, this is where we think we're the best. It makes the founder relationship so much simpler.
Yeah.
To just have that like cleanness and clarity on this is the stage that we back.
Do you think that you could make more money personally with a different strategy, i.e. bigger funds for more management fees, more SPVs, more follow-on? Like,
Short term, for sure. Like I don't care about the short term.
But you think what you're doing now is the best,
yes,
long-term strategy?
Like, I think this level of focus in a city like New York, in an ecosystem like startups, like there's so much that we could do. There's so much that we could say yes to. I think like for Lucy and myself, the clarity of focus is what's likely to drive the most returns in the long term.
Let's talk about the math on that, though. You don't have to give specific numbers, but you get rich if your LPs get very rich, mm-hmm, right? So let's talk through the math of how your $30 million and eventually $50 million super focused pre-seed 6 to 8 deals a year at sub $10 million valuations. Walk the audience through the math of how everyone crushes it along that journey. And then I'm going to try to probe a little bit on like, what if it was this way instead?
I think the easiest way to answer this question to start is we have 4 companies that get to $1 billion in valuation. And depending on what's happening with the market, the company, we either sell a full position there, part of the position there, you know, but if we have like 3% of all of those companies, when this $1 billion price tag is out there, if we have 4 out of the 30 that get there, we've 3x'd our fund.
Sure.
That's where I would start to answer that question.
And then the pushback, I don't disagree for the record. Yeah. I just think this is an interesting conversation. The pushback would be, okay, so let's just say there's a pool of 10 of those in your portfolio that, mm-hmm, have the potential to do so, 8 of which you, at the stage where you could invest more money, you've got the conviction, eyes wide open, there's still risk, right? If you had either a more aggressive SPV strategy or more follow-on capital or a bigger fund, right, hypothetically, you could say, yeah, rather than go from my 10% ownership to 3, I'm going to go from 10 to 8, or I'm going to increase, yeah, my ownership position. So then you're, yeah, going to own at the IPO, you're going to own a much larger percentage.
Yeah. I think if and when we ever start to consider more SPVs, I don't think an opportunity fund is right for us, but
sure,
I think it would be very late in the company life cycle.
Yep.
Like our LPs are investing in us because they want exposure to early stage. A lot of them have exposure to late stage already. They're in the multi-stage funds,
yep,
already.
Yep.
So I almost feel like, right or wrong, I would probably like wait longer than most.
Barbell.
To even like consider doing an SPV. Like I think it would be like Series B, C, D pre-IPO in a very exceptional situation where we're still very close with the founder, and I'm like so sure that this thing can make money.
Yeah,
like really hard to be so sure.
100%.
And I already think I'm asking my LPs to take a certain amount of risk where I feel like I am the best at it. And so I think just my bar, my like reputation bar for being like, put more money into this thing that's still super risky. I don't know. The upside is high, but the downside is high too, to the trust point, right? It's like, you trust me to do this thing I have a historical track record at, and I'm going to just keep doing it and hopefully get better and better and better at it. Later stage investing, it would be like a new territory for me.
Sure.
I'd kind of like rather leave it to the blue chips who are good at it.
Understood.
Yeah.
What have I not asked you that I should be asking you about what's on your mind, what you're working on, or what's important to you?
Selfishly, I'll just share some spaces that we're like exploring from a thesis perspective that we want to meet incredible founders. You know, we're down to talk to folks like even before they've quit their job, right? Like we want to give them the $1 million that will like help them get the conviction to kind of quit their job. You know, we're definitely pre-seed generalists, but we spend a lot of time in the areas that we know best. So we think a lot about the future of supply chain, logistics, warehouses, you know, robotics. We love to talk to folks that are building there. I think that world's going to look very different in 5 to 10 years. We think a lot about healthcare, both on the software side and on the tech bio side.
Yep.
We're thinking about some opportunities in, you know, marketplaces in like really complex, unsexy businesses. Think legal tech, ed tech, insurance. And I would say that's probably my selfish ask. If anyone knows someone, top 1% smartest person they've ever met that is thinking about a problem and a solution and in those spaces, we'd love to talk to them.
Amazing. Here's the question we'll end on. For the audience here who is likely some combination of a founder, an executive, a VC, or just a very super ambitious person, maybe still in school, maybe they're young. Whoever's listening to this, they're ambitious and they want to grow and they want to do new things and they want to keep onward in their journey to take over the world in their own way. What are most people getting wrong?
Oh, interesting. I feel like my answer like depends on the age. I'm just like, are you in your 20s or 30s or 40s? I'm mid-30s. So I'll just answer for like what I think people are getting wrong at this stage in life. I think in your 20s, networking can be like a quantity game. It's like how many events, communities, places can you go and meet interesting people? And I think in your 30s, it's like going deeper. You know, I think like to make it very tactical, right? Like we actually did a huge analysis of where our deal flow came from, the angels, the co-investors, you know, and I used to have like monthly calls with like dozens of co-investors. And now I'm like, wait, there's like 5 or 6 people that angels, operators in particular, that I want to see every single thing that they're looking at.
Mm.
And kind of just like shifting the mentality a little bit towards like once you have the really broad network that you've like hustled and worked your ass off to get, at a certain point in your career, like there's an argument probably going deeper with the folks that you feel like there's the most kind of opportunity to grow with and do business with.
Sort of like the power law of venture.
Yeah, there you go. Our love now works.
Cool. You're the best. I'm so impressed by you. I'm very happy to continue to see you succeed. Honored to have you on Uncharted and looking forward to much more success and good conversations to come. Thank you, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.